Blog Talk Radio.
You are listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio. You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the holy ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, hello everybody. This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from Booker County in the mysterious Ozarks in Mid-America. And we're talking with Jason Gray Wolf Lee. How you doing, Jason? How you doing, Jason? What's going
doing
on?
Doing well, my brother.
In Texas. And we're talking...
Matakwayasa to everyone.
We're talking before the show about some health issues my wife had and some neat things that are coming down the pike. And so what's going on in your life?
Well, I got your email where you wanted to discuss spirit. And I thought, gosh, what a great time of year to discuss spirit.
Yeah, whatever you want to talk about.
And so I've been dwelling on that for the past couple of days. And I've made a few notes here and there, and mostly put it to memory, you know. If it's inbred in me, I pray to the great spirit, God of many names, of whom I call Father, to embed into my mind and to give me the right words at the right time for those who are in need of the right words at the right time. And so if you'd allow me to give us a quick prayer here,
sure,
I'd like to start us off with that and hope that everyone will join us in a meditative sort of a prayer. Great Spirit, who many call God and I call Father, we ask to open our hearts and minds that we may discuss the meaning of spirit, Grant us the right words that we may also share in wisdom, hope, and in our dreams for a better world in which to live in and to seek out all things made by you, our spirit and the spirit of other living things, all things made by your mighty hand. Aho. Amen.
Yeah, it's that time of year again.
It is, and I hear everywhere, Otter, the term the spirit of Christmas. And I was thinking the other day, well, what is the spirit of Christmas? And I have to honestly admit, it's been decades ago. I'm not that old, but decades ago, at least three, I sort of gave up on the materialism of Christmas. I had this girl that I was just terribly in love with, and she wanted this particular gift, and I worked and worked overtime, and I scrimped and I saved, and I went and bought it, and it just cost me everything I had. And you've probably figured out it was a diamond ring. And I gave it to her, and it turned out she was the wrong person. And it was quite a blow, because it was all done in this spirit of Christmas, you know, this spirit of giving is what I found it to really mean. When people say the spirit of Christmas, they mean the spirit of giving. Well, shouldn't we be doing that every day of the year, you know?
Right.
Shouldn't we give to others as we would hope they would give to us if we are in need? And I would think that that would be a daily practice, you know, not just one day a year.
That's right.
And why does it have to be a material gift?
You can hear me, can't you?
Know? Just the gift of a word of passion, a word of love, a word of hope, you know, or an act, you know, some act of giving someone what they need, and that act may be the shaking of a hand, you know, something that simple. I was at the VA just Thursday, and I saw this elderly man. He must have been that eldest man there, and there were hundreds of men at this VA clinic in Fort Worth, Texas, where I go. As he looked like maybe the last survivor of World War I, and he was in a wheelchair, and it just seemed like he was just sort of in his own little world, and people, it's like they wouldn't look at him or something, like, oh gosh, he's so old, I don't want to touch him because I might turn old, you know, myself.
Right.
And I sat there, and he kind of looked over at me, and he kind of grinned a little bit, and I gave him a salute. And all his face just lit up, you know. And,
oh, yeah.
And he was just, you could just see that it just made his day. And I walked over and I put my hand on his shoulder, and I could see that he had, you know, I think it was Parkinson's or something. And
Our
hands shake quite a bit, you know. And I reached down and I touched his hand, and his hand stopped shaking.
Wow.
And I told him that I was grateful for everything he did, and I was proud to be in the same room with him, and I wished him well for the rest of the year. And I just sat back down about 7 feet away from him. And the entire time I'm sitting there, we're waiting to have our blood drawn, you know, and you pee in the little cup and everything. And it can be quite a wait, several hours, you know, depending on how many people are there. And I must have sat there about an hour, hour and a half, and the entire time he didn't take his eyes off of me. Now, to some people, that would make them a little uneasy, and occasionally I would glance and I'd see, oops, yep, he's still looking. And I thought, well, it's fine, you know, it's fine by me, because maybe he could see me, maybe he couldn't, you know, maybe he had glaucoma, I had no idea, maybe he just saw a blurry image. But whatever he saw, there was something in that communication we had that he needed. And there was something in that communication, Otter, that I needed. And I think that's why we were brought together. That spirit of giving that we're talking about.
Yep.
So it doesn't have to be a gift in a box with a ribbon on it.
veterans,
it doesn't have. Pardon?
Veterans, they really have that gift. They really give. You know, they get taken advantage of. You know, but you can go into the service and come out with a broken body, and you can either be bitter about it or you can turn it into something good.
That's right. That's right.
My wife is a naval veteran too, so she gets pretty good care at the VA. She loves going down there. She really does. A lot of good people.
Well, that's wonderful. That's, you know, God bless her. And if some of the younger people who are listening to the show would go to, it's not only military, active military soldiers who we need to care about. It's, of course, our veterans who have fought that fight. And we also need to remember that these young guys, the average age of a soldier over there in Iraq right now is 19. The old swingers, as they call them, are 23 years old is the average age. Now, in Vietnam, it was different. The average age was 19 for the youngest, but for the swingers, as they're called, in other words, the leaders of the group, it was 30 to 35. So we had a little bit older people, older sergeants, older lieutenants, older captains to look up to and to take commands from. So it really troubles me. Today we hear about the 11 soldiers who got killed in this mine that was planted under the driveway of this building they were entering to search. And they were all killed horribly. So it doesn't matter how much equipment they have and how much protection they have. If evil is going to find its way to them, it's going to find its way to them. And when they come home and they're broken up and they're missing an arm, they're missing a leg, or maybe they just have a bad attitude, then they become veterans. And that's when I think military people are really needed, and they need to be appreciated more than when they are in uniform. Because I think when they are in uniform and when they're wound tight, so to speak, and they're armed and ready to go, we all know, and we all appreciate them, and I think that they know it, you know. It's the veterans who don't know it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's so sad.
So any act of kindness towards a veteran is a wonderful thing. That's a gold star, I would have to say, for anyone who reaches out to a veteran and helps in any way they can, even just a friendly hello.
Oh, yeah. They're wonderful folks. They really are. Some of my, you know, when I think about it, all my favorite people are vets, you know, with an exception or two. And they really appreciate it. They really appreciate it.
Well, let me ask you, Outer. What do you believe to be the spirit of man, or the spirit of human beings? We don't want to leave out the women. You know, what is the spirit of the human condition?
The natural spirit, or the one that comes after they become spiritually awakened? I think naturally. Well, you know, look at how men. I don't know. You know, a lot of people talk about, you know, want to think that we lived in some kind of garden. That Native people here in the Americas lived in some kind of Garden of Eden. But you know, we know now that, you know, there were wars, and one of the Sioux tribes, I guess they were putting in a park or something. They discovered an old gully that. Apparently for tree rings, they found out during that period of time that there was a lot of stress on the environment. And, you know, one tribe massacred another and dumped them in a mass grave and covered them over, you know, so. But I think it depends on, you know, whether you become spiritually awakened or not. And otherwise, I think that the natural just the natural man without a kind of a spiritual awakening really is, you know, probably a little bit smarter than the animal, but animals do things out of instinct. But, you know, when men do bad, you know, they do it because they've thought it over, you know what I mean? But animals do it, they do it because that's just their nature. So, and, you know, I think the spirit of giving, which is the spirit of charity, is really the highest thing that we can attain to. I think it's the best thing for our soul, too.
Well, I may have put you on the spot by asking.
No,
that's
all right.
Lot of people,
much as I disagree a lot with the Apostle Paul, I think he was full of bull on a lot of things, you know, especially about paternalism and all that kind of stuff. But you know, I have to agree with him about faith, hope, and charity. Charity's the best.
Is the greater? Yes.
Native people call it the giveaway.
That's right. That's right. And to these philosophers and religious leaders, they seem to separate spirit from soul. I went back as far as my greatest teachers were Socrates, Plato, only because I studied and taught philosophy and religions of the world, because I was so upset. Our book on religions of the world was as thick as a Dallas phone book, if you can imagine how thick that is. And there was maybe one paragraph given to Native American in terms of religion. And it mentioned that there were so many various tribes, they said over 2,314, I thought I'd never forget that number, that there were just too many various beliefs to mention. And yet they had a whole chapter on Hinduism, chapters on Christianity, chapters on Buddhism, and it just really amazed me. And so I got into thinking, well, if spirit is man's communicating with the man's existence in life, in other words, trying to obtain that spiritual goodness that brings him closer to the light.
Yep.
Or to God, the great spirit. Spirituality into lost that light or has misplaced it. Because if we are to believe that all living things have spirit and all humans, once they're born, are given a spirit, and of course you would think, well, all infants are basically good until they learn evil. We have to learn evil just as we learn good. So the closer we are to the Great Spirit, the more goodness we have in us. And the further we go or drift from the Great Spirit, the more we are influenced by evil. So if spirit is that focal point, and soul is the driving force, or let's just say the stomach of our body. We need fuel, you know, to keep walking around and doing things. I would think that would be our soul, and many people, including Socrates, Plato, and even Abraham and Moses, as far as that goes, and black elk, have pondered the question, well, is the mind the actual spirit of the body? You know, it's our mind that does all the thinking, you know, that tells us what to do, that helps us write essays or, you know, write a song, a poem, or do something with our hands, you know, to create something. So maybe spirit is actually our mind. Although I personally disagree with that particular belief, and I don't even waste my time thinking about it.
You know, they're discovering now that, you know, since they've done transplants, you know, the people got somebody's heart, and they'll come up with memories of the person, the deceased, or even parts of their stomach, you know, and that they're identifying that there are certain cells in the heart and in other parts of the body that are very similar to some brain cells. So maybe the ancients were right, you know, that we had a heart and we had a brain, and it looks like that memory is not completely something that's behind the eyes.
And that isn't that amazing?
It's in your gut and it's in your heart and who knows where else.
Well, a long time ago, I heard my mother, first let me mention this. My mother is a retired nurse, so I sort of grew up around medical people. And her specialty was a surgical nurse with a heart doctor. I think his name was Dr. Auctioner, Alvin Auctioner. He kind of pioneered the first heart transplant. And she was the nurse who was fortunate enough to be involved in that. Now, they lost a few patients, and in so doing, they discovered that when...
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater. Would you think twice about defending yourself or a loved one from an intruder? In this day and age, would you dream of leaving your doors unlocked at night for fear of being burglarized or even attacked or worse? Would you? But when it comes to our own bodies, the doors to our houses are wide open all the time. The very air we breathe and the food we eat, especially here in the United States, creates free radicals that cause us to age and in some cases cause illness, some of which are deadly. Now, for the first time in history, there's a supplement called Protandim that is listed on the U.S. government's PubMed.gov website with many peer-reviewed studies all showing that Protandim is a proven killer of the free radicals that are aging and in some cases even killing us. Now, I'm not talking about killing one molecule of free radical per one molecule of antioxidants like the stuff we've been taking. I'm talking about killing 1 million free radicals per second, per molecule, and this is the very same antioxidant your own body produces. Protandim supercharges your body to create much more than it does without Protandim. There's an old saying that we are warned about in the scriptures. That's the attitude, eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. So let me ask you, how much money do you spend on food a day? If you're out shopping or at the beach, would you think anything of spending a buck or even more on a can of soda? If there was a vending machine that sold something that killed what was aging you or even killing you, would you even hesitate to spend a buck and a half a day? Well, now there is such a vending machine, and it's sitting right in front of you. It's at www.defendyourownbody.com. That's defendyourownbody.com. Visit us now. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Will Bluewater. I have a message here from 1975 from John Wayne. It comes right out of today's headlines. So you Indian folks who are following the progressive trend in politics, you're following the people that supported slavery. You're following the people that have enslaved you ever since the Civil War. Listen to John Wayne.
You know, it's a funny thing, the Indians now. This AIM group have started something that now they're against me for some reason. But I am the only man in pictures that always gave them their human dignity. I never was in a picture. I never allowed myself at any time to do anything that would take their human dignity away from them. And that, to me, is the most important thing in a man's. I have found that a certain type that calls himself a liberal, and I always thought I was a liberal. I came up terribly surprised one time when I found that I was a right-wing conservative extremist. When I have listened to everybody's point of view that I ever met, and then decide how I should feel. I mean, but this so-called new liberal group, Jesus, they never They never listen to your point of view, and they make a decision as to what you think, and they're articulate enough and in control of enough of the press to force that image out for the average person. For some reason, maybe it's these pictures, they have not been able to do that with me. In spite of what they say, people have not taken sides that I'm a, it hasn't affected my career in popularity, let's say. In spite of the fact that they've tried to make it do it. There isn't a hell of a lot that we can do to change human behavior. We keep making laws to try and change human behavior. You can't do it. I think you can accept it and feel how you would feel in that position. You're being conned into Keynesianism and socialism now. But it isn't going to stop the selfishness of human behavior. It isn't going to stop the greed. If you take $20 and give a dollar to every son of a bitch in a room and come back a year later, one of the bastards will have most of the money. I mean, it's just human nature, and you're not going to whip it with a lot of laws. I think when you make people conscious, as communication gets better, and you make people conscious of somebody in trouble, starving or something like that, the average person will help. But of course now they've got so damn many charities and there's so much professionalism, if you have a charity, you hire some professionals to work up the charity, and by the time you get the money, you get $4 for the recipient and $400 for the administrators. So, I mean, Christ, I think there are people who try to affect a thinking where they know more than some other son of a bitch and try to put a false impression on what human nature is. Christ's sakes, we have proven that we go back to hope at the first opportunity. Just throw out a little fish and bam, they're out there ready to grab it. So we are optimistic. We have to be optimistic. Christ, what else would there be in life if you lose optimism?
We pass away, all of us, no matter our height, our weight, we lose 8 grams of weight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, is that spirit? Is that what the spirit is? Does it actually occupy weight?
Well,
and if so, does it weigh 8 grams?
Thanks to the Hubble Space Telescope now, they now know, I guess it was early last year, they came up with this big announcement saying that they discovered something called dark matter, and they realized that the matter that we can see, I think, is only 17% of the matter in the known universe, and that what we can't see is well above 70%. So matter has weight. And I'm beginning to think that the natural abode of man is where the majority of the matter is, and that's dark matter. And that's where we come from. You know, we come from a place where we're not heavy, and, we don't have to fight against gravity and time and all those other kind of things. And I haven't got it all figured out yet. But we certainly know are learning more, and we're learning it very quickly.
Yes, and that's the difficulty, I would think. At least I found in my long years on this earth, the difficulty in being a good person or a spiritual person in such an evil world, in our surroundings on this evil planet, is in maintaining that goodness or that spirituality to hold on to being a good person when there's otherwise so much evil going on in the world. And it just seems like there's just so much more evil than there is good, you know? And we very often, you turn on the news, and of course, 98% of it's bad news.
Yeah.
A couple of the TV stations are throwing in a couple of caveats at the end of the news, some good news about, you know, somebody helped somebody else build a church, or somebody helped some children build a school, and, you know, that's all fine. That's wonderful. But there's just so little of it, you know. Always, I worked in TV news off and on for about 20 years, also in radio, and the rule of thumb in TV news is if it bleeds, it leads, which means the first story of the evening is going to be about somebody bleeding somewhere.
That's sensational.
That's right. That's right. So we're surrounded by all of this evil, not only in the world, but in our daily activities. And then we turn on the television or the radio or pick up a newspaper, and we see and hear and read about all of these evil things. And I just wonder how many people sit back and wonder, where's all the good? And do they go out and try to find it, you know, or do they think about the good even? Because there's so much evil in the world. Yeah. I'm looking at a little quote here. And it says, are we closer to God? And although we see and understand that there is evil in this world, being spiritual means to be closer to God. For God is peace and love. Even though God is a jealous God who will reap vengeance upon your enemies. And who are your enemies? Or who are the enemies of God? Those who do evil things.
Yep.
That was St. Thomas Aquinas, a philosopher and also, I suppose, to a major degree, a monk, one of the more intellectual Christians who ever lived, I suppose.
There were vast differences between, there's vast differences between men, there's vast differences between priests, and there were some really amazing people. You know, like the ones that follow the conquistadors and wrote down all the crimes they committed, you know. It's amazing.
That's right. And I still believe in my heart and my soul that despite all of the evil that's going on in the world today, and, you know, any moment now, there could just be mushroom clouds all over the planet, you know. I mean, that's all it takes is just the one push of a button. And we're all vapor, you know. Where have all the great people gone, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, Johnny Cash just died. You know, it's interesting. You see the really, really good people dying, you know, and you know, people like Princess Diana die, and I don't know. I say the good die young.
Yeah, that's right. And what I see happening, Otter, is, you know, too much hero worship. I was changing the channels the other day, and I saw them interviewing all of these pretty babes out in Hollywood, you know, these Hollywood actresses, and they're all beautiful. You know, it's like none of them are, you know, plain Janes anymore. You know, they're all beautiful and, you know, million-dollar bodies and all of that kind of business. And yet they're so vain. You know, all they talked about was themselves and how much better they were and how much better they wanted to be and this and that and everything else. And then, of course, with the men as well, you know. Well, my next project, this and that and everything else. And it's just amazing to me to try to find the great people. And I think that in this day and age, the great people are really the quiet people, the people that we don't hear about. People like your wife who goes and visits veterans, people who go and visit sick people, who help out people and don't expect anything in return. The people that we just never really hear about, those are the great people.
Oh, yeah, unsung heroes. Yep, absolutely. My dad never, he didn't think I appreciated him very much, but I did. Of course, he had kind of an inferiority complex. But
I was
a professional engineer, you know, born in 1917 and professional engineer. And he just did some unbelievable things in his life.
He was born in 1917?
Yeah, graduated, became an engineer in 39, and between he and his brothers, you know, between he and his brother graduated from the military academy, you know, they may have saved this country twice, you know. His brother was also an engineer, and one of the airplanes under his command snapped a picture that started the Cuban Missile Crisis. Kind of interesting.
Well, that's interesting. He was born when World War II ended.
Yeah, well, he was born...
He was the son of... I get my Indian blood through my mom. Dad was born in Minneapolis in 1917, and he was the salutatorian of his high school and his university, and not just over his own college, but all of the sciences. He missed valedictorian by like the fifth decimal point. And I even got his college transcript, and they found out years later he actually was the valedictorian. But in spite of that, he received a fellowship to Harvard. He was the same age and was in the same class as JFK. And would have been in that same graduating class. But his father, Dad's dad, was a Swedish immigrant. His mom was a German immigrant. It was during the Depression, after the Depression, they just didn't have the money to transport him. He got a fellowship, which is much more than a scholarship. But a fellowship covers all your tuition and books. But the transportation just couldn't get him there. So he went out, he was a Johnson Foundation scholar, and he got everything paid for at University of Minnesota, and went on to do some fantastic things in aerospace. But, always felt underappreciated, and always felt like I didn't appreciate him very much. It wasn't that, he was from old school. You know, he was like 37 when I was born, and... I had an older sister who was born in 42, 12 and a half years between us. And Dad, she just didn't understand me, But I loved him dearly. He was quite a guy. He's one of these guys. He was an altruistic person. He went into engineering because he wanted to help people. And, there were several times that he refused to... violate his oath and, sign off on a design. He knew I hurt somebody and lost his job. Those things happen, I can't say that I've got he had integrity, he was a little nutty in some other areas, the times he grew up and were just unbelievable. The Great Depression, but his dad did better than most. His dad was a cook and had his own restaurant, but You know, they had table scraps from the restaurant. They ate better than most people back in those days. And, you know, I grew up in a completely different world. But, you know, there was this real dichotomy about Dad. He kind of resented me for how good I had it. But on the other hand, he kept saying, well, I went through all this stuff so you wouldn't have to go through it. And then in later life, he resented me because I was enjoying those things. So, it's amazing. It's amazing.
Parents are amazing.
They're just people. There's no instruction book comes with a baby.
That's right.
You know, there's no, and kids don't have an instruction book on how to deal with parents either. And especially when they become teenagers. You know, my second wife firmly believes that when kids become teenagers, they would be taken off and dropped off on a desert island until they're 25. You know, so I'm beginning to agree with it, I tell you. I've got a son just past 20, and, you know, he went through some of the things, but he's sure a good kid, and he was 9 and a half when his mom died, and he went through some tough times, but he moved to Seattle last year, and he's been up there a year, and he's an apprentice carpenter. He just loves it up in Seattle. I've been lucky. I was told, it was really interesting that year before and the year after my first wife passed away, the veil was very thin for me, and the spirit spoke to me and told me a lot of things. I actually told my wife Betty, because I remarried immediately after Joanne died, told her that that if we didn't raise Joseph with honor, he'd be taken from us and given to somebody else. Boy, you know, that threw me into a tizzy. Well, you know, go to the library and see if you can find a book about honor. You know, the only place you're going to find it is in scouting. Is the only people that, and thankfully, you know, I had a degree in youth leadership and had been an executive with the Boy Scouts for a few years, so I knew a little bit about the subject. But honor, as Rob Roy said in that movie not too long ago, it's that thing that you give yourself. And it's all the good things about, it's what we're talking about. It's the spirit of Christmas, you know. It's doing 12 months out of the year. It's kind of like, you know, when people talk about, doing good 7 days a week rather than one. Native people like to say, well, you know, we just don't worship on one day of the week. We do it all seven. And I don't know, I guess I was told very young that the gift of charity would characterize my life, and along with the attendant poverty, which is good for you. It's all while you're going through it, but poverty's good for you. There's nothing wrong with. I was raised upper middle class, and I had enough of that. I wanted to see how the other half lived. So I did.
Well, it takes a. I remember a song titled by Bob Dylan. It takes a lot to laugh, but a train to cry.
Oh yeah, isn't that the truth?
And you'd have to be at least our age to know what that means. You know, to have ridden on a train and saying goodbye to someone on a train, and you know, et cetera. But it's true. It takes a lot to laugh, but a train to cry.
Yeah, that's certainly true.
You were just talking about honor. I'm looking at a song that I've written. Well, actually, I wrote it back in 1984, and it was one of the more requested songs I would do at colleges. I don't know why at colleges, but I guess maybe that's, you know, the point of life when people are young enough to open their minds to learning. And I'm looking at the chorus as you were talking about honor. And the chorus, if you'll allow me to recite it real quick.
Sure, go ahead.
Time may tell its tale on you. It can run out before you're done. But honesty will look out for number one. You may find a fortune or get down to your last dime. So do your best with honesty and time. Now, there's three verses in there, so, you know, it's a complete song. It's one of my longer songs.
That's great so far. You know, it sometimes is very painful. Abe Lincoln was right. Honesty is the best policy. And, you know, I learned early, you know, it's rather than spend a bunch of lies, like most kids do, you know, you get caught in that and you tell another lie, and your parents remember that stuff, and then you forget your lies and they figure it out. Like, it's best just be honest and contrite and just admit, you know, the hardest thing I've ever had to go through was after my wife Joanne died, the lady I married, who's a very long-suffering person. You know, she pointed out that I was becoming my dad. You know, my dad had, like I said, he was old school. But, he's, you know, he could be a real jerk. And it's really hard, you know, when you get to be middle-aged, and I'll be 50 next week.
Ah.
And on the 8th, it's really hard to admit that you're becoming what you hated about your dad. Oh, it's so hard, you know, it's very hard to face negative things about yourself and to change them.
For me, brother, it was just the opposite. My dad was like my best friend. He was the Cheyenne.
Yeah.
Part of me. My mother's side is Irish, so I'm Cheyenne and Irish. And many people say that makes me an Indian with an attitude,
mm-hmm.
although I think that's a gross exaggeration. But with me, I always found it difficult to get along with my mother.
Hmm.
In fact, we never did. We were, you know, it's like a bulldog and an alley cat. You know?
Yeah, I got along pretty good with Mom.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
It is so great to have our friend Marie Osmond back here on GMA, and she has some important information about making sure your family is prepared for natural disaster. She's the new national spokesperson for Wise Company, which makes dehydrated and freeze-dried emergency foods and food storage products. She's here to tell us about that. Marie, you've been given the opportunity to endorse probably 9 billion things over the course of your career.
True.
Why the Wise Company?
The reason I wanted to do it is because it's affordable. You can eat a meal for a dollar. It's less than school lunch. It's affordable, but really, look at what's been going on with Sandy and Katrina. I mean, what was it, $78 billion of damage done just here in New York and
right.
New Jersey.
So what is this?
What it is it's emergency meals. And, you know, it's not your grandmother's kind, not the beans and rice and the gross chicken-tasting
right.
garbage. This is lasagna and really good stuff. And I swear to you, why am I here talking about this? Because I know it's going to save thousands and thousands and thousands of lives. You put it under your bed. It's convenient. Stick it in your closet. If something happens, I have it in my car. All you do is you open it and you add water. You don't even have to add hot water.
Right.
And it's affordable. It's convenient. It tastes really good. Taste the peaches. They're fantastic.
This is a peach?
But they're different than every other company because it's like dehydrated. And freeze-dried, and they combine whatever. I swear, it's fantastic. Just try it.
I'm trying it right now, Marie
Osmond.
Put it
under your bed, put it in your closet, give it for Christmas to people, and save lives.
Thank you very much. Will you tell Donnie that we said we hope his rear feels better?
Well, you know, it's kind of a bummer, but I'll tell him.
No, Marie Osmond, great having you on.
It's
the Wise
so fun
Company.
To be here.
Great to be with you.
It's always fun to be here. This is a great place.
All right.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater. If you'd like to find out more about Wise Foods, visit wisefoods.org.
Now my mother's elderly and very ill. I had a feeling one day about 6 weeks ago, well, actually 7 weeks ago, to just stop in and check up on her. And I came in and found her in a diabetic shock and had to call an ambulance, and she was in the hospital for about 2.5 weeks. And I've been staying with her ever since because I felt, well, that's why. You know, I was led over here to see how she was doing, to check up on her, and I found her in that condition, so now I need to stay with her for a while, and it's really difficult, and I have to keep reminding myself, Otter, you know, this is the woman who carried me for 10.5 months, you know, in her body. I was a late baby in that day. 10.5 months, yeah, I was, you know, like coming out with a beard, you know. And she made many sacrifices for me and my life, and yet she could do the slightest thing and it'll just irritate the heck out of me, you know. And I'll think, you know, gosh, you're as bad as a child, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And it's just that she's very ill and she's going through memory lapses and things like that, and she'll forget and leave the refrigerator door wide open and the milk out on the table. Or,
yep.
You know, just things like that. All of the things of which we probably did as little children until we learned better.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's really a very, very difficult time for me right now and having to help care for her. And
yeah.
She also has nurses who come by every other day or so and check up on her and do things for her. But they aren't here 24 hours a day, you know. They don't see what I see and hear what I hear and go through
yeah.
all that.
My mom is 84. My mom is 84. Dad died a couple years ago, but I guess he'd be gone 3 years now on the 7th. But mom is 84. You know, the women always outlive the men. Most people don't know that about 90% of the wealth in this country is controlled by old women, and because they inherit it from the men that make it. And they're all stressed out, and they die young. You know, they're 60s, and their wives live till they're 90. And mom and dad wanted mom's brother to be the conservator of the estate, and she's in a rest home near Knoxville, and I never get to see her. And you know, he said, "Oh, you can't take care of her." He's probably right. But it's tough not being able to visit her, and because you just don't have the transportation to get over to see. And as far as the family's concerned, I move around too much, so you know I suppose she could be transferred, but you know to a home nearer to us. But I think they hesitate to do that because they're afraid I'm going to flit off to Mexico, or and they might be right, you know. So yeah, it's really hard. My mom. She can't, her memory is such that she can remember things that happened 20 and 30 and 40 years ago. She just can't remember what was said 5 minutes ago. So she'll ask you the same questions, and 5 minutes later the loop starts, you know, and it's really strange. But so when she starts into that, I just start talking about all the old days. And she remembers all that perfectly. But because of the diabetes, you know.
Right. Yes, I know.
And,
my mother suffers from it.
Yeah,
it's really an awful thing. It really is. I lost my father. He died in '76, so I think I was 23 when he passed away.
Mm.
And this was my best friend. You know, when I was 9 years old, I felt funny calling him Dad. You know, he was like my friend, my pal.
Oh,
you know?
Wow, that's a good relationship.
Sure.
If you were that close
one,
to
him. One spanking my entire life. I was 9 years old and I stole the family car. And I got two telephone books. I think I was in the sixth grade.
Oh, man.
And I sat on the telephone books and had Coke cans, or maybe they were even beer cans. I don't remember what kind of cans they were. But I taped them to my shoes so I could reach the clutch and the
brake. Oh, my gosh. Did you say sixth grade?
Yes.
Yeah, you were about 11 or 12 then.
And I drove the car. I stole the car. Not really to steal it, but just to drive it.
Joyride.
Because when I was a little boy, he used to let me sit in his lap and do the steering. And I steered, turned corners, you know, did the whole nine yards. I was only 2 years old. But then I was riding the horse at, you know, like 11 months.
Oh, so wow.
I grew up fast, I guess, but. Anyway, I drove the car past the school, and, you know, it's like all the my school friends were out, and it was just a big deal, and then, oops, ran out of gas.
Oh, you're lucky.
Right there on the main drag, so pretty soon comes a cop, and then before you know it, there's, you know, like 24 cop cars.
I'll bet.
And they're all encircled, and then the newspaper came, and they're all just making this big deal about this little 9-year-old boy who, you know, set on 2 phone books and stole the family car and went for a joyride and ran out of gas.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, Dad gave me a whipping, and it was really kind of a joke in a way, because he told me, he says, "Son, I hate to do this."
Yeah.
Because
hurts me more than it's going to hurt you, blah, blah, blah.
<That's>
it probably did.
it turned out his father, my grandfather, Big Four, the Cheyenne, gave him beatings with a buggy whip when he was a little
Ooh.
Boy. So he was physically abused as a boy, and he didn't want to ever do that to me. So
my dad got it with a razor strop from his dad. Of course, he used to talk about he'd get it from the razor strop, but you know, as I got older, I said, "Dad, I said now I'm wishing that you did because with a razor strop because when I was a little kid in the early '60s, it was those little skinny people don't remember those little skinny belts that were in style. You know, we're talking about belts that were half inch wide." That's what I got it with. You know, not with the metal part. Dad would loop the belt and pop me a little bit. When he could catch me.
Yeah.
You know, but, those stung. But I think, you know, you get something bigger and wider and heavier, and I don't think it would hurt as much as that stupid thing did. You know. But,
well, that's what he used on me. He just, you know, sloughed that belt right off, and it was one of those real thin...
Belts.
Because he wore a suit every day with the job that he had.
Yeah, and my dad too.
And he whopped me three times with that belt.
Oh, man.
And, you know, the first time he said, was that hard enough?
Oh,
and I said, well, it kind of hurt. He said, well, I probably ought to do it a little bit harder. So he hit me harder, you know, right on the butt. And he says, well, what about that? He says, is that enough? I said, that's a pretty good one, Dad. You know, that was a good one. And he gave me one more, and he says, okay, that's it. He says, just don't do anything like that again. And then he left the room, and I found him in the backyard crying.
Crying. Isn't that something?
And then he told me, I'd always ask him about those strange scars on his back. And
he told
me the story of his dad, my grandfather, whom I never liked. From childhood on up, I never liked the man. Told me the story of the buggy whip. He just, for no reason at all, you know, be late taking the garbage out. He'd get, you know, beat with a buggy whip.
I'll bet he had drinking problems.
He did.
Yeah.
He was what they call a functioning alcoholic.
Yeah, yeah.
He could be drunk as a skunk and you wouldn't know it.
Yeah, yeah, that really brought out really the worst thing in a lot of Indians. That Indians and alcohol did not mix.
Yes.
It's really, really sad.
And he died at 52. I mean, just imagine that. You're
going
to be 50. So just imagine 52. Of course, Errol Flynn died at 52.
Hmm.
It's just kind of amazing to me. But and he died, actually it was a heart attack, but of course his liver was shot.
Yeah.
Because of his drinking. And they had taken out almost all of his intestines, so he got down to about 90 pounds. And this is a man that was 6'2" and weighed about 210. He died in 76. Well, in 77, they invented angioplasty.
Oh.
And, of course, if he had lived one more year, you know, they possibly could have saved him.
Put the stent in, yeah, yeah.
Which I've had. I've had two angioplasties, and now I have three stents in my heart.
My dad had that when he was about 80, I guess it would have been about 97, yeah. 97 or 98, yeah. Balloon job.
Well, it saved a lot of lives, and I sure wish that it saved him, because I really miss him.
Yeah. So your people were Cheyenne. You know, the traditional teacher around here... he was telling me that back in the '60s, when he belonged to the Will Rogers Indian Club, and he's from over near Springfield, and
Missouri, or
Richard, grandfather Richard Craker, and he's Chickamauga Cherokee and German and Quapaw. But he said back in those days, he says most Cherokee, they weren't interested in Cherokee way, they were interested in Cheyenne way. And I know a lot of Cherokee people that really love Cheyenne way, and they say they're the friendliest Indians that they know. They really love being around Cheyenne people. And they said during that period of time, because most of the Cherokees, they weren't interested in Cherokee way because it just wasn't appealing enough. He said that he became the last student, the last old Ottawahee, and
a guy that could recite his heritage back 500 years.
Wow.
You know, and really amazing. And
well, I wish I knew more about my people. You know, my first sweat lodge leader was Lakota. So I know more about the Sioux way than I do the Cheyenne way, even though the Sioux and the Cheyenne were, of course, very close relatives, brothers, if you will. And of course, the Lakota, Nakota, Dakota, and Cheyenne.
The Seven Fires.
Southern Cheyenne.
Yeah.
They all originated from the Algonquin tribe, as did the Cherokee, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And many, many other tribes all originated from the Algonquin tribe. So, really, that's what makes us all brothers. But they do have a way about them. In fact, the Cheyenne were called by other tribes, the Crow, the Sioux, and even the Apache. They were called the Beautiful People.
Mm.
And really, if you look up the languages, that's what it interprets. One of them, the Lakota, interprets Cheyenne as to mean red man, which is kind of interesting, isn't it? You know, Lakotas are red men too, but they call the Cheyenne the red men. But in the Cheyenne language itself, it means the beautiful people. And even the early French trappers who came here to America, and they came in contact with the Cheyenne, they called them the beautiful people as well, and chose many of them, or shall we say, hijacked a lot of the women,
mm-hmm.
took them as wives.
Yeah, have you seen, I'm not changing the subject, but I'm going somewhere with this, but a couple, 3 weeks ago, did you get a copy of the announcement from Sydney Has No Horses? Who's I believe he's in Oglala, Lakota, that he made an announcement at the council meeting of the Cheyenne River Tribe concerning. Now he's a grandson of Fool's Crow. He's also a Sundance chief, medicine man, traditionalist, and he said that he has been visited by a couple of angels. And also by Chief Bigfoot, Chief Sitting Bull, and Crazy Horse, and they told him that if the Seven Fires don't come together in some kind of unity, that there's going to, and he specifically mentioned some earth changes that were going to happen regarding the West Coast, and also something about the Missouri River because of volcanism. In other words, he also said this winter was going to be very, very, very hard. He says it's going to get cold and it's not going to warm up, and he says they're going to lose a lot of cattle. And it's already started. You know, 2 weeks later after the announcement, here we go. We got these tremendous storms up on the plains, and it's going to be an interesting winter.
I'm sure of it, and I don't have to prophesy it. Here in North Texas, the other day we had a 25-mile-an-hour wind that came through, and we've had record days of heat. You know, one day it set a record of 90 degrees, whereas in 1919 the record was 72. You know, so you know, gosh, it's you know almost 30 degrees difference. But the leaves from the trees from this high wind. Being blown off, and usually up here in North Texas, the leaves never change color. They just drop from the tree, and the trees look barren, you know, with no leaves on them. It's not like in Tennessee or up there in your way where they change colors and, you know.
Because of lack of water. You always have a lot of water down there.
That, right.